Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 20 years ago next month, November 9th, 1989, the Berlin Wall fell and Eastern European communism crumbled. Michael Meyer was there in the tumultuous run-up to the fall as a correspondent for Newsweek magazine. The years since, he says, have reduced the story of the wall coming down to too simple a myth. A myth, he says, with costly consequences. This hour, On Point, the whole story of the fall of the Berlin Wall and the year that changed the world. You can join the conversation. Were you there when the wall came down? Were you watching, dancing? What's the story you tell of what made it fall? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Here it was, November 9th, 1989, BBC News covering the opening of the checkpoints in the Berlin Wall.
This is the middle of the checkpoint. The gates have been opened. The police are making no attempt to stop people as they go through and come back. I have never seen such elation.
It was an astounding development. No one who was there or saw it will ever forget it. But what went into the run-up to that amazing, amazing development? Joining me now from New York City is Michael Meyer. He was Newsweek's bureau chief for Germany, Central Europe, and the Balkans from 1988 to 1992. He's now chief speechwriter and communications director for UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon. His new book is The Year That Changed the World, The Untold Story Behind the Fall of the Berlin Wall. Michael Meyer, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Tom. Hello.
Hi, it's great to have you with us. There's an amazing amount of wonderful detail in here, and we want to hear it. All the ins and outs with Vaclav Havel and Lech Walesa and your heroes of all this, the Hungarians, and of course Mikhail Gorbachev. But I want to go straight to what jumped out at me from this book as the kind of money quote at the end of your analysis after all these years, and then come back to the detail. You say, looking at the fall of the Berlin Wall, and the American sense of that as having been an American victory, a Ronald Reagan victory either. You say it was a straight line from the fantasy of Cold War victory to the invasion of Iraq. Explain that, and we'll come to your history of the fall of the wall.
Well, Tom, it was very exciting, I have to say, listening to the opening of the segment with the cheering crowds. Yeah. And the tumult at the opening of the wall, it brought back an awful lot of memories, and what a night that was. Every American, I think, and I watched the Berlin Wall come down from the east side. I didn't see it on television, so mm-hmm. a lot of the drama, as far as I was concerned, was at the street level. I have no sense of really what it looked like on television back here. I suspect it was even more dramatic.
Looked pretty amazing. Yeah,
it was pretty amazing. But it also colors your view of history, I'd have to say. If you're looking at a television and you see people standing on top of a barrier that was the very epitome of the Cold War, the Berlin Wall, and people are dancing and cheering and drinking champagne, I mean, how can you not celebrate? I celebrated, too, along with everybody else. It was America's triumph. We won the Cold War. Now, I don't pretend to be a revisionist historian here. I'm not saying that America didn't win the Cold War.
And why not celebrate? That was an incredible moment of freedom.
Why not celebrate? It was an incredible moment of freedom. If I don't know how old you are, Tom, but I'm old enough to remember ducking and diving in under my high school desk practicing for the next nuclear strike.
And I'm not quite there with you, but of course we all know duck and cover.
Well, and rock and roll was a protest song mm-hmm. against much of what happened in the Cold War, from Vietnam to you name it. Mm-hmm. But when the Cold War ended, symbolized by the fall of the wall, of course, we celebrated. It looked like a great victory, containment, the Marshall Plan. The U.S. role was tremendous. But we forget that the way the wall came down in the final year, that year of victory, was a victory by East Europeans rising up, and it was had very little to do with us. Now, I'm from the Midwest, and when I go out to visit Michigan or upstate New York, talk to my family, talk to friends, 8 out of 10 of them, when you talk talk about your book and these kinds of issues say, well, Ronald Reagan, that's the money line. That's what everybody remembers. Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall. And as if word were deed, it happened. We forget that 2 years separated that moment. But that stand has become a shorthand for a whole worldview, to my mind, a potentially dangerous worldview. And the worldview can be summed up as the Gipper stands tall against communism. Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall. Dictators are hollow at their core. If you confront them, they will fall. The people will rise up, singing joyously about their freedom. Democracy will bloom. And it's a straight line, I argue, from this sort of fantasy of how the revolutions in Eastern Europe happened and the wall came down to Iraq. You confront Saddam Hussein, and yes, he toppled because, yes, he was hollow at the core. But I think it's an arguable point that the people rose up and that democracy has bloomed.
And so you call it a dangerous fantasy. Here's that line, June 12, 1987, Ronald Reagan at Berlin's Brandenburg Gate at the wall, issuing his famous challenge to Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev to end the decades of separation between East and West Germany.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
It was quite a challenge, and the wall came down. It fell on one set of ears, George W. Bush, with a particular sort of way of hearing it, you say, Mike.
Well, it's a memorable line. I am a speechwriter these days for the UN, and I only wish I had written that line. It's probably one of the immortal lines in American foreign policy. The speechwriter was named Peter Robinson, so a tip of the hat to Peter Robinson, Ronald Reagan's speechwriter.
Yeah, a great line. But you're saying George W. Bush took the wrong lesson from the sequence of events?
Well, it's very interesting. Depending on where you stand on the political spectrum, this line, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall, has different meanings. If you're a Dick Cheney or a neoconservative, you might hear it one way. You might hear it as a message of confrontation from that consummate Cold War warrior.
And the epitome of courage and heroism and determination and the kind of line that sets a framework that gets things done.
Very true. On the other hand, there was another Ronald Reagan. There was a Ronald Reagan of the second term, the Ronald Reagan who was a partner in negotiation with Mikhail Gorbachev, who met Gorbachev, the Soviet premier, who was reforming the former Soviet sphere, who had set change in motion, the demiurge, if you will, who had set all in motion, all the changes that we began to see. And Ronald Reagan spoke to Margaret Thatcher, who famously said, Gorbachev is a man we can do business with. And in a series of meetings, Ronald Reagan concluded that here was a man indeed that we could do business with. And he began doing business with him. They became friends. They began engaging. Ronald Reagan went to Moscow. He addressed Moscow University. This was engagement. This was collaboration. That speech in Berlin to East Europeans and to many Europeans was an invitation, less than a direct confrontational challenge. It was a challenge, an invitation to join me in helping bring down this wall, to join the West, to embrace change. And that's how East Europeans heard this very famous speech.
And the point you make is, as you see it anyway, George W. Bush got half the message, and not the collaboration part, not the part of Reagan working with Gorbachev, but the take a tough stand, stick to it. You see that as the myth that emerged here that has danger in its wake because it wasn't that simple then.
It wasn't that simple. It's a stick figure of heroism, of how to deal with totalitarian regimes. And there are times when you do need to stand up, no question about it. But Ronald Reagan was an engager, and it's interesting that for many, particularly on the conservative wing of the Republican Party, Ronald Reagan is in his later years when he was engaging Gorbachev was considered something of a heretic, if not an outright traitor to the cause. And when George Bush, one, came into office, they took a pause. They did not want to have this detente with Gorbachev. So they put a freeze as they on relations as they reviewed U.S.-Soviet relations. They went back to a much more strident tone. They called Condoleezza Rice, working for Brent Scowcroft, who was then National Security Advisor, likened Gorbachev to a propagandist, her words. His aim was to get the United States to lower its nuclear guard in Europe. Mm. They painted a picture of a Soviet Union busily rebuilding its military, prepared to roll through the famous Fulda Gap in the heart of Germany, all the way through Frankfurt and perhaps to the English Channel. This was not what was happening. And, in fact, Ronald Reagan introduced the new president during the transition to Gorbachev on Governor's Island. They had lunch here in New York. And Gorbachev looked George Bush, 41, in the eye and said, "I am not a pretender. I am not something other than what I seem to be. I am doing what I am doing, changing my world because I have to. My system doesn't work anymore. I am a partner. You can count on me. You will be counseled to go slow, to review, to take stock. But I'm the real deal," he said, and he invited George Bush Sr. to join him. Well, that didn't happen until the summer of 89 when George Bush traveled to Poland and to Hungary and suddenly saw for himself what was going on. And from then on, American foreign policy turned on a dime. It became the very model of enlightened engagement.
Bush Sr. saw firsthand. George W. got what you describe as the myth and acted on it. Michael Meyer, please stand by in New York City. The new book is The Year That Changed the World, The Untold Story Behind the Fall of the Berlin Wall, and we will come back with the detail. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the real story of the fall of the Berlin Wall, November 9th, 1989, 20 years ago, next month. Michael Meyer is with us. He's author of the new book, The Year That Changed the World, The Untold Story Behind the Fall of the Berlin Wall. He was Newsweek bureau chief for Germany, Central Europe, the Balkans from 1988 to 1992, right in the thick of all this. Michael Meyer joins me from New York, and your big heroes in this story are the Hungarians, Michael Meyer. Tell us why.
Well, it's very interesting because I had never visited Budapest, and all my life I wanted to visit this beautiful city on the Danube, the former capital of the Habsburg Empire. And in December of 1988, just after I arrived in Eastern Europe and Germany as Newsweek's correspondent, I was reading a Reuters Wire Service story, as I recall, and it was talking about things that sounded very uncommunistic for a communist regime. They were going to – here was Hungary talking about creating a stock market, you know, talking about creating a free market.
In the heart of communist East Europe.
Yeah, talking about forming political clubs. And I wondered, my goodness, could these become political parties? Because with Gorbachev in power in Moscow, suddenly the climate was created for experimentation and the Hungarians were really starting to experiment. So I went to see for myself. And I met all sorts of high government officials. There was a new government in place. They had taken office just 3 weeks earlier, about the same time as I arrived as a young, fresh correspondent. And so we were all newcomers, watching some dramatic times. And I went to meet the new justice minister. Now, you have to back up a minute and think of what a justice minister in a communist regime represents.
Yes.
This is the man who ran the secret police. This is the man who threw dissidents in jail. This is the man who, if you were an enemy of people, made your life really, really miserable. And so I went in to expecting to meet sort of a thick-necked former, you know, valve operator or machinist or something, with barely an education, which is what these guys often were. And I expected, you know, a big, fat apparatchik who spoke bureaucratese. And instead I met this curly-haired, burly, human, educated, brilliant man named Kalman Kulchar. And he was talking to me about the freedoms that we take for granted in the West. He talked about free elections, free speech, free association. You know, this was a land where newspapers were censored still. Free press? And when he started talking about free elections, I asked him, well, what if you lose an election? He said, well, we'll stand down. And I laughed at this because, you know, for four decades, communists have been holding elections. They always won by 99%, and it was impossible to imagine a communist regime stepping down as though this were somehow the most natural thing in the world. And he looked at me laughing, and he said, Mr. Meyer, you don't believe me. Hmm. And he opened the – bent over, and he slid open the drawer of his desk, and he took out a pamphlet. And he waved this pamphlet over his head and looked me square in the eye and said, Mr. Meyer, what do you think this is? No idea. Sheaf of papers? He said, not at all. You should know. He said, it's a copy of the U.S. Constitution and the U.S. Bill of Rights. Pause. Mark my words, Mr. Meyer, this will be ours within 9 months.
Now,
he was wrong.
Right.
He was wrong. It took them 10 months.
Yeah, not too far off, though.
Not too far off. And that's the moment. That, for me, was probably the most dramatic moment in the year, because that's when I realized, at a time when hardly anybody else did, that huge events were in motion that would change our world, and the hair literally stood up on the back of my neck. I always thought it was a figure of speech, Tom, the hair standing up on the back of your neck.
But there it was not.
It's literal. It's not.
This was the time of Václav Havel in then Czechoslovakia, of Lech Walesa in Poland. There was much else afoot. But your minister was called on the carpet by the rest of the East Bloc there in what, in earlier era, might have been the end of his, I don't know, entire crew. Instead, he got a twinkle from Mikhail Gorbachev, and the Hungarians went on.
Well, I call this a bit tongue-in-cheek, the wink that changed the world. Let me. You have to understand the backdrop here. As they were talking in December of 88 about free elections and all the rest, they began acting. They did form political parties. They scheduled free elections.
Hungry.
They lifted censorship. Mm-hmm. They created a stock market. They began experimenting with capitalism. These weren't just reform-minded communists. These were guys who were out to knock down the whole system. And in March of that year, Miklos Nemeth, the new prime minister, felt he had to fly to Moscow to meet Gorbachev and explain what he was doing. And he explained, we're going to have elections. And he explained to Mikhail Gorbachev, we might lose. And Gorbachev was appalled. What are you doing? You're jeopardizing socialism. Mm. And he went on and on and on in this rant. Gorbachev was a communist to his core, make no mistake. And poor Miklos Nemeth, this 40-year-old prime minister who had never had a meeting like this in his life, he thought he was going to be sent to jail. But then suddenly Gorbachev changed on a dime. He said, but of course, comrade, this is all up to you. It's your responsibility. You make the choices. And Nemeth asked the key question. So, comrade Gorbachev, if we are thrown out of office in a free election, will the Warsaw Pact, the Soviet Union, intervene as they did in 1968 in Czechoslovakia or 1956 in Hungary, violently crushing blood in the street? Gorbachev looked him square in the eye and said, "Niet." Now, this no was all important to Nemeth, who flew back to Budapest and accelerated the pace of his change. By summer, the Warsaw Pact, the leaders, the hardliners particularly, who wanted nothing to do with these kinds of changes, either by Gorbachev or anybody else, were running scared. And they had watched as Hungary did things that were totally beyond comprehension. In May, Nemeth summoned international TV crews to the border with Austria. BBC, CNN, Newsweek, Time, New York Times. And they handed out wire cutters, invite everybody to help them in cutting a hole in the Iron Curtain. They were literally cutting down the fence. Nemeth called it a barbarism, an anachronism. We don't need this. We want to join the West, he said.
He called the fence an anachronism, but this was kind of, in a way, a trial run for the Berlin Wall coming down.
It was exactly a trial run, and that was their intention all along. But they wanted to see it, play it by small steps, to see how Moscow and the others would react.
And they'd invited Germans who were on hand to go through that hole in the fence into
Well, we're home. Getting a little ahead of ourselves, but by July, you can imagine how this played. In July, there was a meeting of the Warsaw Pact, and the hardliners launched an attack on Hungary and Nemeth.
Ceausescu, Jaruzelski in Poland, the others.
Jaruzelski stayed mum, but it was mainly Erich Honecker in East Germany and Nicolae Ceausescu in Romania and Miloš Jakeš, the hard man of the Czech Republic, the most conservative hardliners. Mm. And they were braying for Nemeth's head. They wanted a Warsaw Pact fraternal intervention, which meant tanks in the streets.
Mm-hmm.
And Gorbachev was sitting at the center of this table. The tables were draped with flags. There were the standards of the flags of the Warsaw Pact around the room. This was a summit of high commie ceremony.
Mm-hmm.
And Ceausescu was waving his fist in the air, and Honecker was shouting for Nemeth to be arrested and for literally a fraternal intervention, Warsaw Pact mm-hmm. troops in Hungary to stop this, what they called dangerous experiment that could only bring down the Warsaw Pact. And Nemeth looked across the table at Gorbachev, the one man who could say yes or no to this adventure. And Gorbachev winked at him. Strictly speaking, as Nemeth described it later to me, it wasn't quite a wink, although that was the word he used to describe it at first. It was more a twinkle in Gorbachev's eye, a sort of crinkling around the eyes, as though to say, you and I know what this story is, almost laughing, as if to say, as Nemeth himself put it to me, pay no attention to these idiots. And
the rest of the Warsaw Pact.
The rest of the Warsaw, pay no attention to these idiots. And so Nemeth didn't. He, as Ceausescu was standing up, waving his fist in the air, Nemeth just casually got up, sauntered outside, and smoked a cigarette on the veranda, the wink that changed the world.
And history rolled on. I've got a little bit of tape.
And history rolled on.
Indeed, it did. August of that year, with this famous Hungarian-organized pan-European picnic. And this is speaking through a translator in a Reuters interview this year. This is a former East German remembering his surprisingly easy escape from communist Eastern Europe thanks to the picnic that came in August, where they were invited in and the wire cutters were out. And here's the tape.
I crossed through a hole and there was this Austrian who said, "Welcome to freedom," holding a piece of barbed wire like a rose. I couldn't believe it. In my mind, I was expecting a first wall, then a second wall, a third one, like here. But he said, "You're already in Austria." I told him, "No way."
2.5 months before the Berlin Wall comes down, going through essentially the wall, the fence in Hungary. Here's the former Hungarian Prime Minister, Miklos Németh, speaking through a translator, talking about the plan to allow East Germans to escape to Western Europe to test Mikhail Gorbachev's tolerance of the actions of the reformist Hungarian government.
My plan was to test whether Gorbachev's claim about every country being responsible for its own borders was really sincere. If nothing happened, then he was serious. But if there had been any interference on that day during the picnic, then history would have taken a different course of events.
Former Hungarian Prime Minister Miklos Németh there, of course, it did not take a different course of events. And on November 9th, 1989, down came the Berlin Wall. Michael Myers with us. His new book is The Year That Changed the World. I want to turn to some of our callers, if I may. Mike Caroline in Virginia Beach, Virginia. You're on the air, Caroline.
Hey, how are you?
Hi, fine, thanks.
Good, yeah. This is was a truly amazing time in history, and it's something that's near and dear to my heart on a personal level. My dad escaped East Germany in the late 50s when he was just an old teenager, 19 years old, and I remember distinctly, I'm 43 years old now, and we visited our family and friends who were still in East Germany in the summer of 1989, and it just broke my heart when we left because they would be always very sad. They said, you know, we would love to visit you in America, but we can't. And
did they have any sense that within weeks or months that wall might be down?
Isn't that funny? That was just the ironic part. We were all saying, you know, they called us idealized Westerners, and they said, oh, this can't change. Jürgen Schuchat was the name of our, he's still friends today. And I said, Jürgen, this has got to change. You cannot just be restricted to visit Czechoslovakia or, you know, pick your East Bloc country. This has got to change. And I just think the time was ripe. The energy was there. I mean, the momentum and all the other things that your guest was talking about, you know, the wheels were turning. And it was really just a matter of time. And it was so amazing when the wall did come down. I remember I had tears in my eyes, and I was thinking that I would never have thought, you know. I mean, it still seemed so far away, because as kids we would travel to East Germany, and it was a world apart between West Germany and East Germany. You would literally cross this border and be in a whole different, you know, government and country, and Erich Honecker's picture on the restaurant walls, you know, and it was just so different. And to think, you know, that within, you know, months, change happened was truly, truly amazing.
Caroline, thank you for calling. Michael Meyer, her German relatives, friends didn't see it coming. Did you, traversing this area in those months before the wall actually just came down, did you see it coming?
I did see it coming. But only because I was traveling everywhere, and only because I saw the game that was in play. And you could only see it by being there on the ground, up front, close and personal. Caroline is right. The wheels were turning. In Poland, by this time, the summer of 89, Poland had an election, and they had tossed the communists out. Solidarity was forming a government. This was revolutionary. It gave a sense of what was possible to everyone else in the Eastern Bloc. Now, we listened to Miklos Nemeth a moment ago. That his description of testing Gorbachev does not do justice to the subtlety of this man. He was very much a quiet man, very much a technocrat. But if ever there were a revolutionary, it is he. He is the unsung hero of 1989. He put in place a plan, years in the making, maybe 2 years in the making, to bring down the Berlin Wall. Now, this sounds like hyperbole, but it is not. He had a plan worthy of Operation Fortitude. Operation Fortitude, you might recall, was the famous plan, Winston Churchill's, for tricking Hitler into thinking the D-Day invasion was going to come in Calais rather than Normandy, which made all the difference in the success of the invasion. It was a subterfuge of dramatic, epic proportions and dramatic, epic, iconic effect. This picnic you referred to earlier was a culmination of that plot. You remember my mentioning they cut a hole in the Iron Curtain in May. They did it again in June, this time summoning the foreign minister of Austria and the foreign minister of Hungary to wield the wire cutters. But nobody was taking advantage of these holes. East Germans who came to Hungary every summer in the hundreds of thousands to vacation were not, quote-unquote, escaping. So Nemeth and a few others, fellow conspirators, if you want to call them that, organized a picnic right on the border. And they sent flyers to all the camps where East Germans were staying, saying, come have a picnic. There'll be a band, you know, a brass oompa band. There'll be beer. There'll be hot dogs. But be careful. There's no Iron Curtain. Why, you could stray over the border into Austria and no one would know.
Imagine.
And they distributed little maps to help people not to, quote, unquote, stray. And they chartered buses from across Hungary to bring these East German tourists to this picnic site, and gee, what do you know? A couple of hundred, 600 or 700 of them escaped. They just walked right over the border through a fence, and the border guards had been banished to a distance at Nemeth's orders.
This was no accident.
It was no accident, and there were Hungarian border police checking passports, but they would only check passports of Hungarians, of Austrians coming to visit, not East Germans, quote-unquote, escaping.
And through they went, and soon enough the wall came down. We'll go there with Michael Meyer. His new book is The Year That Changed the World. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the real story of the fall of the Berlin Wall, November 9th, 1989. 20 years ago next month. Michael Meyer is with us. He was Newsweek correspondent in that neck of the woods from 88 to 92. He's looked back now and written the book The Year That Changed the World, The Untold Story Behind the Fall of the Berlin Wall. Michael Meyer joins us from New York City right now from Chesapeake, Virginia. Jay, you're on the air.
Thank you very much for taking my question. Very interesting conversation. A couple points. I would like to have the gentleman answer the question. In any way, did the fact that the Soviets lose their war with Afghanistan and the country was basically broken, the army was broke and demoralized, contributed? But as I remember this, and this was at the time of Ted Turner's fledgling 24-hour news channel, CNN, so you couldn't get away from it. I remember the name Lech Walesa very prominently, and I also would like to have him answer the question, if any way, how did Pope John Paul II, who I believe was from Poland, contribute to this reawakening of Catholicism in the former Soviet Union countries? And I'll listen to the radio for the response.
Thank you, Jay. Three big factors: the Soviets and their Afghan defeat, Lech Walesa, the Pope, Michael Meyer.
Well, thank you for your question, Jay. Yes, you put your finger on three big things. The Pope. The Catholic Church essentially kept solidarity alive during the black days of martial law. Solidarity had been crushed in December of 1980. Its leaders were thrown in jail by General Jaruzelski. And for the years up till 1989, Solidarity, the great trade movement opposition group, was living in the shadows, and the church kept them alive. And of course, Pope John Paul, when he visited Poland, was the very epitome of the Polish spirit for change. So he was a symbol. But Catholic support was critical. And Afghanistan was a symbol of the limits of power for the Soviet Union. Yes, the Soviet Union could have prosecuted that war for more years. It was terribly expensive, and it was breaking the army. And you're right, Jay. The Soviet army was a shell of itself by this point. I remember having a conversation with some specialists in the Soviet Order of Battle before I went to Eastern Europe. This was at a place called the Institute for East-West Studies, where a woman named Condoleezza Rice was on the board.
Soviet specialist.
And in those days, she was talking about, again, the Soviet military buildup. And a friend of mine, who is a British intelligence officer and scholar, whose specialty was the Soviet Order of Battle, looked at her and said, "Condi, what are you talking about?" And he walked through the Order of Battle in a Czech, in a Soviet tank battalion in what was then Czechoslovakia. The Soviets were cannibalizing all their tanks. Out of a tank battalion of about 800 tanks, he figured between 11 and 15 of them could actually move because they were cannibalizing parts just to keep them going. The only people who could fit in these tanks had to be drivers, had to be small enough to fit in them. And most of those were recruits, draftees from Kazakhstan and elsewhere, many of whom had never been to school. Now, driving a tank is a very complicated piece of equipment. They hardly knew how to do it. His bottom line was, "Condi, these tanks can hardly roll out of their base, let alone through the Fulda Gap," which told me a lot about the state of the Soviet army in those days. Now, let me just relate one thing that's not often spoken of in this context but was critical and relates to the state of the army. The Soviet Union had no money. Oil prices, their chief export, almost the sole source of their foreign currency besides arms, was at a price in May of 1981 of $45. By the time that Gorbachev came to power in his first year as premier, it had declined to between $8 and $9. Imagine what that would do to Soviet finances. Mm. They could afford nothing. In fact, when Miklos Nemeth went to talk to Gorbachev about cutting a hole in the wall, he told Gorbachev not that it's anachronism, not that it's a barbarism, which is what he really thought. He justified in terms of not being able to afford it. Rabbits were always setting off alarms. The metal was rotting. The only place to get replacement parts were from the West, and they didn't have the hard currency to do it. He said, "Comrade Gorbachev, I will happily keep this Iron Curtain intact if you will pay for it." And Gorbachev replied, essentially, no way, we don't have the money. Those are Namath's words, not mine. But
so
what
What was Gorbachev's fundamental calculation then? Was it as simple as dollars and cents in an empty treasury that led him to the famous wink or twinkle in the eye that, in your telling, was a kind of green light for all that came after? What was his fundamental calculation?
His fundamental calculation that it was he could improve socialism. He could do two things. One, create a socialism with a human face, as Dubček of the Czech Republic famously put it. And secondly, reform communism so that it was economically functioning. He was wrong on both counts.
Let's get a call from Paul in Wellesley, Massachusetts. Paul, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Great topic on this show. Certainly one of the most momentous events of my lifetime. Mm. And Mr. Meyer, I agree with you 1,000%. I think the myth that it was Ronald Reagan's military buildup and saber rattling that was the sole cause of the fall of the Berlin Wall is both wrong and very, very dangerous. And you've talked about that and about Reagan's engagement with and diplomacy with the communists. I'd like to talk about the third leg and what I think is the most important leg of that stool, and that is that it took us 40 years from basically 1945 to the 80s to prove to the world that our civilization was better than communist civilization. That people lived more prosperous, more successful, more happy lives under a capitalistic system than under a communist system. And for that, we have presidents from Eisenhower to Carter to share the thanks. I mean, after all, as you're talking about the sort of indigenous uprising, none of that would have happened if all of the people in Hungary and Poland believed that the Soviet lifestyle was the pinnacle of civilization.
And Paul, surely that credit extends through Ronald Reagan as well, wouldn't you say?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. My point simply is that it's American society for 40 years that deserves credit for all of this, and the American system.
Michael Meyer, how do you respond?
Well, Paul, I certainly agree. The power of our example was tremendous. In all these cases, people yearned to go to America, particularly Poles, particularly Hungarians. But remember, too, Paul, that Miklos Namath didn't say he wanted to join America when he was plotting to tear down the Iron Curtain and bring down the wall. He said he wanted to rejoin Europe. And I suppose they're synonymous, America, Europe, the West. But they weren't really the same systems. Western Europe had perfected a brand of socialism that works very well and would continue to work very well today if they had, say, higher birth rates. This, too, was a power of example. So it's not only the American way. That's a quibbling caveat to what Paul said, which is, of course, true.
Of course, we come ultimately to November 9th and the wall coming down. And you recount wonderfully how that in itself was a kind of accident, a kind of misinterpretation where an East German official, this was Günter Schabowski, had come out and for an international press conference and had sort of mistakenly announced that all the rules for traveling abroad were lifted immediately. Immediately was the key word there. And tens of thousands of East Germans flocked to the wall that very night. It wasn't the plan. But listen, here's the historic tape. You'll explain it to us. Here's Günter Schabowski on the eve of the fall.
Bitte?
Ab sofort.
Also, Genossen, mir ist hier also mitgeteilt worden, dass eine solche Mitteilung heute schon verbreitet worden ist. Sie müsste eigentlich in Ihrem Besitz sein. Das tritt nach meiner Kenntnis, ist das sofort. Unverzüglich.
Sofort, a snippet of German that sent East Germans flooding through that wall. Michael Meyer, remind us what happened.
Well, this is the vindication of the British cock-up theory of history. Many people often have a view of history that's, if I may say, tectonic, as though history somehow happened because it had to happen this way, the product of forces that are somehow inevitable, all-powerful, relentless. No. accident plays a huge role in human destiny. And this is what we saw on the night of November 9th. That man, Günter Schabowski, speaking in German, was a newly appointed press spokesman for a bunch of East German reformers who were trying to do a Mikhail Gorbachev in East Germany. And one of the things they reforms they instituted to seem more responsive, more open, was to have a press conference every day that would be televised live to the nation. And on November 9th, Günter Schabowski appeared before the assembled reporters of East Germany and the world and made an announcement. Now, the backdrop is that there are demonstrations in the streets. People are marching in Dresden, Leipzig, Berlin. Germans are still escaping through Hungary and elsewhere, pouring across to the border with Czechoslovakia. The new regime wanted to stop this exodus. After all, the Berlin Wall had been built to keep people from leaving. Mm. And tens of thousands of people were leaving. East Germany was hollowing out. And so the regime decided to give East Germans what they wanted above all else. As Caroline, your earlier caller, said, East Germans wanted to be free to travel, just tour the world when they wanted to, go places. And so the regime that day, November 9th, had passed a set of laws giving Germans, East Germans, visas, but subject to rules and regulations. There would be stamps. You had to get a visa. You had to, fulfill all sorts of rules and regulations. Your whole family couldn't go with you, for example, because that would be an invitation to just leave permanently. But this had all been passed and approved and was to take effect the next morning, November 10th. But Günter Schabowski didn't know this. He hadn't been in the debates, and he had been on vacation for the previous 3 days. And so he stopped by the chairman of the party's office and said, anything to announce? And the man said no. And they said, hey, wait a second. Read this out. This will do us a power of good. And it was the press release that had just been drafted to announce this revolutionary new law. The German regime, East German regime, thought they would be heroes. They thought they'd get the hosannas, as Günter Schabowski put it, of the people. There would be a debt of gratitude to the regime. But he neglected the fine print. When does it take effect? And so that exchange in German that you just heard was the fatal question.
And sent the torrent heading for that wall.
Sir, when does this take effect?
Yes.
And Günter Schabowski didn't know. He shuffled through his papers, looked through the press release. He finally settled on the only words that he recognized, ab sofort, right now, immediately.
Yeah.
And so it happened. You know, I had just gotten over the border at Checkpoint Charlie. I wasn't at the press conference. I was outside. Mm-hmm. And I noticed all these people hitchhiking. Now, you don't hitchhike in a communist regime. That's illegal. You don't do it. Mm. But people were on the streets. Something had happened. We picked up a couple of them. One of them, I'm a kid named Sasha. We took him back to it. We had this rental car. We'd just driven in. We took him to his apartment. He told us what had happened. He told his parents what had happened. He took some money out of his sock. He packed a little knapsack of supplies and said he's off to the checkpoints to go to the West. His parents didn't know what to think. So we drove him to Checkpoint Charlie. It's about 8 in the evening or so, 7 o'clock. There were maybe 30 people there. Within 5 minutes, there were 100 people. Within 7 minutes, there were 500 people. Within an hour, there were a couple thousand people. And as the evening wore on, a cold, cold night, misty, a little bit like here in New York right now, the crush of the crowd was such, and they kept flooding in like a river coming up against a dam. Thousands of people pushing closer and closer to the border guards who were in a line in front of Checkpoint Charlie with weapons. Mm. And the crowds had pushed so close to the guards that their breath was mingling in the light. There were these yellow arc lights, and it was cold. Your breath was steaming. Only 10 feet, 6 feet separated the police from the people. It was scary. I mean, what happens if somebody panicked? What happened if a shot was let off? What happened if a dog started savaging a protester and people started to protest? Any of these things could have happened. It was a dramatic, tense moment. And the interesting thing was that after Schabowski's mistake, there was nobody to correct it. I could see the captain of the Border Guard Checkpoint Charlie standing in a glass box on his telephone, dialing and dialing, getting more and more frustrated. He could find no one to talk to, could get no instructions. Nobody could tell him what was up. Mm-hmm. And finally, he came out of his box and shrugged. And he said, Alles auf, open them up. And the gates opened, and the first person through the gate was a little woman I'd been watching for the last couple of hours. This was at 11:17. I'd been watching her for about 4 hours. She was in her blue bathrobe with blue hair curlers and blue fluffy slippers on her feet, and she was the first person through to freedom, the face of freedom, if you will.
Michael Meyer, his new book is The Year That Changed the World. What's the reality you want people to take away from this fuller telling of history? It's not to take away from Ronald Reagan, but there's a kind of reality check that I'm reading you hope people absorb.
Humility, a sense of proportion, and more abstractly, when it comes to foreign policy, the sense of limits that any the sense of limits on any nation's power to accomplish what it thinks it can. You have to put things in the context of the rest of the world and other people. It's a very affirming view of history to look at how the wall actually came down as opposed to how we mythologize it coming down, because it comes down to the courage of individuals. Individuals acting in the moment, the courage of the individual to go out on the street when you could get shot down. And trust me, there was a time on October 9th, 1989, when the East German regime was ready to do a Tiananmen and shoot people in the streets. The power to stand, the power to speak truth, the power to make a choice. Any great crowd is a collection of individuals making choices in the moment, and that is humanity.
All good history to remember as we approach the 20th anniversary on November 9th of the fall of the Berlin Wall. Michael Meyer's new book is The Year That Changed the World, The Untold Story Behind the Fall of the Berlin Wall. Michael Meyer in New York, thank you very much for joining us today.
A pleasure, Tom.
Listeners, thank you for joining us. You can continue the conversation or get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.